Welcome to the OpenIC. My name is Toby Liebsch. Celebrity VCs get a bad rep, but is that really appropriate? Today I'm talking to Vic Zazi, who is a partner at Dreamers VC. Dreamers is the venture capital arm of Will Smith and Keisuke Honda, and they've invested in a ton of Silicon Valley's hottest startups. Vic and I are discussing the role of celebrity VCs, how their investments can leverage their reach, and how they fit into the VC landscape. We're brought to you by FinTalent.io, the hiring platform for tier one M&A talent. Let's go. Let me start with a little story, because of course we're going to talk about the role of celebrity VCs today. But I think 2017, during the election, Trump versus Clinton. I was in the US, and of course now I'm in the Netherlands and Amsterdam, but I was in the US and I was visiting, and that was also about the time when, the whole, like, might Trump win the election, a topic really cooked up in the late night shows. And like every good tourist, I made it to Stephen Colbert, you know, these kind of free tickets you get for the late night shows. And they were supposed to have John Oliver on, I believe. But then when I went, Will Smith actually was guesting on the show, right? And that was really my first, I think, touch point with a tier one American celebrity, I think, US celebrity. And I don't think I've ever quite witnessed an audience exploding that much, because just the sheer presence of Will really made everyone erupt in the audience. Like, how was it for you to work with someone like that?
You know, it's funny because he's such a force, I should say. And you know, for a lot of folks that are my age, I'm 35. You know, they grew up sort of watching Fresh Prince, and you know, I was a kid, you know, watching that, and so. It was so strange when I first met him, because you feel like you've known him for 30 years and he's like a close friend, and you've like experienced, you've seen all these, like, the arcs and, you know, and troughs, you know, during the story of that show, and just all the, you know, amazing movies he's done since Independence Day, saving our country from these alien overlords and stuff. So, you know, when I met him, I was, you know, you just feel like this, like, kinship or connection, when in reality, he has no idea who you are. And you also, of course, know him because, you know, he, as a celebrity, you know, most of your life is just out in the open. But yeah, no, I mean, it's obviously just such a, it's such a privilege to be around someone as talented as he is. And you know, and certainly he has a whole, you know, satellite and cast of folks around him that are supporting him. And it's not even just him. I mean, his wife, his kids, you know, they're all icons and future, or really current and future, just, you know, huge, huge talents themselves. So really, really excited to see where they take sort of their careers.
So next to working together in the VC, it sounds like you also kind of grew a bit closer as colleagues almost, is that correct? Or?
Yeah, you know, he definitely has a lot, you know, so much going on. And to be quite candid, he has a lot cooler and more profitable things to do than run an early stage venture fund. So, you know, in that sense, he kind of entrusts us to sort of manage all of the deal flow and sort of, you know, allocate, make investments and be a good steward of capital. So I would say, you know, he does so many different things. He and Jada have their own family foundation. They support Jaden's Just Water and all of his, you know, sort of social impact initiatives. So, you know, we're very much, leveraging his name, image, and likeness and brand, you know, in purpose of advancing sort of his mission, which is to use his technology, influence, and in, you know, whenever it comes to a capital to improve lives.
Yeah. But of course, for the business model of Dreamers VC, Keisuke Honda is also kind of the other part of it. I must be honest, like, I had to research him first because I wasn't so familiar with him, but I think you described him as a David Beckham of Japan, to me in our pre-conversation. Hope I can say that. And how is your relationship with Keisuke? Is it, like, I guess you weren't, did you know him before? Were you as starstruck as with Will, or is it, how is that relationship?
I would say he's a little more, well, you know, for one, not that we're ever trying to compare them, but it, you know, it's certainly a little bit of, I wouldn't say he's as, you know, on the same, you know, sort of tier as Will, just given he hasn't been in the limelight for that long. You know, he's far younger. But Keisuke is certainly a force in his, you know, in his own right. I think he's one of the top Asian World Cup scorers, certainly for Japan. And just given, I don't think they have, you know, as many athletes on the, you know, on the global stage, he obviously occupies, you know, an extremely high level and is this beloved star in Japan. And so, you know, when we were walking around, when we were in Japan with him, or even just in the US, you know, all of a sudden you'll see like we're walking down like Market Street in San Francisco, and all of a sudden you'll see like some Japanese tourists just lose it on the street. And so that's been, and, but, you know, I had never really been around any of these influencers or talent or celebrities, whether global or local. And so, you know, it's always just as humbling and starstruck as it always is.
Yeah. Yeah. But you did work for the Clinton Foundation before, right? So tell me a bit about your background, how you actually got into those circles. Did you meet Will at a party and then suddenly you hit it off, or how, what happened there?
Yeah. So when I was, so I started my career in international development. So graduated from college, was a wayward soul, I would say. You know, I read Muhammad Yunus's Banker to the Poor. And after that, I was like, you know what, you know, maybe social impact and international development is the next step in my career. And so spent about five years in international development, a year and a half in East Africa, 3.5 years in Haiti, where I spent some time with President Clinton's foundation. So it wasn't until I went to business school, following that, I was in University of Chicago's full-time program, where I was just exposed to the full breadth of, different parts of finance. And from there, I transitioned into early stage venture, joined a corporate venture fund, and then Dreamers. And the way I got introduced to Dreamers is I have a very close friend from high school. And when I was at his wedding in like 2015, I met the gentleman who would end up being the head of Will's family office. And so when I was an early stage venture at the corporate fund, I would always reconnect with my buddy. He was like, hey, you know, Will's family office, is like spinning out, or like trying to launch a fund that is not going to be any of Will's capital. We're actually going to be getting all Japanese capital, and it's going to be doing it in coordination with Keisuke. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was initially very skeptical of, you know, these like celebrity led influencer funds. But when he said that it was going to be structured like 2 and 20, you know, everyone was going to be properly incentivized, and, you know, we're going to run this like a real fund, that's when my ears really perked up. And so, yeah, I was super excited to come and help launch it.
Yeah. And what motivated you to go into VCs in particular? So why did you choose another path in the finance world?
Yeah, I mean, and I wish I had a better answer to this, but, at the time, you know, I wrote my essays about going into impact investing, and yep. I sort of thought, you know, at the end of the day, I hadn't ever taken a serious business or econ class before business school. So, you know, I was like, look, if in 5 to 10 years, I want to end up in impact investing, what's sort of the best way to get there? And what are the best roles that are currently out there now? Yeah. What are the prereqs to get in? And so, you know, fundamentally, when you look at like the spectrum of finance, or even just in private equity, you know, I'm not sure how it's a lot easier to really, you know, sort of scale your impact if you're starting at venture at the early stage than you are if you're going at PE, where, you know, revenues are mature and stable and growth is, you know, certainly nothing like up and to the right, like venture. So, from a pure financial perspective, I think it made sense to go earlier. And then from a pure excitement perspective, I mean, all the innovation that's coming out of, you know, decarbonization, direct air capture, and all the novel things in crypto maybe that are, you know, sort of taking over remittances, et cetera. That's all happening. All that innovation is happening at the early stage. So, I was very fortunate. I mean, it was just pure serendipity that I ended up in venture. I never focused on it during school, and so here we are.
Yeah. And now you've been privy to some of the hottest deals in Silicon Valley, some could say.
Yeah. I will say that was one of the best, that was one of the most, I guess like shocking things to me, is because when I was at my corporate venture fund, we were backed by a legacy Fortune 250 insurance carrier. And, you know, it was a great team. It was a great setup. And we had, you know, a good amount of capital, $200 million at the time. But we really had to sell our money. I mean, you had to go and, you know, make the case to a founder why they should have you and the corporation on the cap table. Corporate venture capital tends to have a pretty negative stigma. And so you really had to fight and, you know, like prove your value prop and all these things. And then I come over to Dreamers, and here it's, you know, deal flow is 100% inbound. And we have great, you know, we're LPs in Andreessen's Cultural Leadership Fund. So, you know, over 20% of our portfolio has been directly invested with them. And just, you know, the visibility we get, and, you know, we've done about 80 deals in the last 3 years since we launched. So yeah, it's been really exciting. Super just privileged to be, you know, in this position, just, you know, I being in the same room as a lot of folks that I would have dreamed to be 3 or 4 years ago it's still, I wake up every day still smiling.
Yeah. Let's zoom into that relationship to Andreessen. So how does your deal flow work in practice? Do they just send over the hottest deals? Do they send over every deals, or how does your deal flow really work? Also in collaboration with your partners.
Sure. So our LP relationship with the Cultural Leadership Fund, so that actually happened right before Dreamers launched, and Will's family office, the Smith Family Office, invested as one of the first LPs in Andreessen's Cultural Leadership Fund. And the genesis behind the Cultural Leadership Fund was, you know, if America's number one, you know, sort of like unquantified export is its culture, and one of the biggest determinants or drivers of its culture is African-American, you know, lifestyle, streetwear, music, you know, et cetera. I mean, athletes, the whole aura around this, then why don't they play more of a role in tech, which is clearly reshaping our society, you know, dominates market caps, et cetera. And this is run by a gentleman named Chris Lyons, who was just named general partner there, who's an absolutely, you know, he's another force. He's just getting started in his career. And so, you know, their whole point was they were kind of an internal fund where they would co-invest with other deals that all the other entries GPs are doing. And then when they get those allocations, which was, you know, never really a problem, then they would syndicate it to their LPs. And we would go direct onto the cap table of the underlying portcos, not through the fund. And so from there, you know, anytime, so Chris would be there, it is what I imagine, you know, Andreessen commits doing a deal in their IC. And then they'll, you know, and a lot of times the founder will be like, look, like we actually, you know, it makes sense for, you know, we're going after a certain demographic, or yes, this mission makes sense. So yeah, you know, we'll give you some allocation. And then that's when, you know, we'd sort of get the call. They're like, hey, do you want to talk to this company, or this company, or this company? So that's sort of how our relationship with Andreessen worked. And we've certainly gotten to know a lot of the other GPs on, you know, various different teams. And then even just from there, you know, it just kind of, it's kind of like a snowball effect. You know, all the other funds would sort of get to know, like, oh, you know, you can co-invest with Will Smith, and, you know, Jay-Z has a fund or two, and, you know, Serena Williams and all these things, and they're really institutionalizing their operations. And so, you know, basically name got out, and, you know, we started to build our brand, and yeah, today we're 80 deals deep.
Wow. 80 deals. And just how long have you been there now?
3 years. Yeah. 3 years since we launched. So yeah, wow. pretty breakneck pace.
That's a pretty stressful deal flow, I would say. That's awesome. And so let's dive into the role of celebrity VCs in particular, because the general math is, of course, always that on the one side, you know, it's kind of a nice way to get some extra marketing in. But of course, also with the Cultural Foundation and Dreamers VC is particularly a focus on African American demographics. How does that pan out? So is there a certain part in the deal that is allocated to marketing resources, or is Will then responsible to become the face of the brand? Or how can I imagine that in practice, actually?
Yeah. So, you know, first and foremost, we make no, you know, promises that he's necessarily going to do something, or any member of his family. And I'll say, you know, two things. So, you know, first to start off, you know, sort of the allure behind celebrity or influencers, you know, coming onto a company's cap table is that, you know, of course they can, you know, of course it helps with branding, no doubt. And then really, you know, I think the core of it is that if they post about something and the customer ends up converting, it brings that marginal cost of acquiring a customer to zero. And this is in a world where Google and Facebook, end up actually, you know, there's some, like, you know, sort of unproven statistic that like 20 or 30% of all venture dollars eventually trickle their way down to Google or Facebook simply through ads, because so many companies, in particular D2C companies, are trying to acquire customers, these crazy acquisition costs. So of course, adding an influencer who's especially genuinely excited about the product makes total sense. One thing that I think people don't entirely realize, and especially this may be, you know, kind of special for someone like Will, but, you know, if you want him to do like even a 30-second or like 1 minute long Instagram spot, there are sort of two aspects that come into play. When it comes into, like, cause of course this has to be done on sort of like a high resolution, you know, so this is a Hollywood production. He's not going to do some, you know, sort of like low budget, thing. Is that there's the talent fee and there's the production fee. And so the production fee, even for doing something that will get whittled down into a minute, will still, you know, could easily end up being $150,000 or $200,000 over a day or a couple of days, whatever it takes. Because again, this is, you know, these are like high quality, you know, just folks surrounding editors, all the folks doing, the creatives, and so on and so forth. And then there's the talent fee. And that's the fee that Will command simply for, you know, having been in the limelight for 30 years and, you know, of course, doing all sorts of endorsements. And so that can be, you know, incredibly high. And that's something that, you know, is possible to sort of negotiate down and, you know, maybe even waive in very special cases. But the production fee is something that has to get paid because these are, you know, normal folks. They're not influencers who can sort of take a hit, take a zero on just doing something for a product they like. That production fee has to get paid. And for a lot of times, it doesn't really make sense for the startups to pay that amount simply for just a 30-second spot. So I think, you know, if I were a founder thinking about taking on an influencer or celebrity, I mean, one is like understanding what all they're going to bring to the brand or to the company or to the product. And then second is like, if we do want to escalate this into sort of like a commercial relationship, you know, what do those costs kind of look like? Because at the end of the day, you know, if like putting things aside, there comes a point where if you have someone that's really on another level, like a tier one celebrity, and they start to do things for your product, I mean, that's where you kind of have to get the business manager involved because it's like, look, like this is borderline, like a full on endorsement, and he can command millions of dollars if this was Procter and Gamble or Unilever, you know, Kraft, whatever. I know we're on your cap table, but like oftentimes the value that we're delivering on a market value basis is much higher than, you know, the allocation that we invested.
Yeah, isn't that difficult to really screen for a founder? I mean, of course, for Andreessen, it's pretty good catch. You know, you say, okay, we bring Will on the board, let's go. But for the founder, it sounds like that might be a bit difficult to really, yeah, screen the impact of that, right? And to understand the impact of that beforehand. That's often criticism I also hear about, yeah, these celebrity VCs, right? Like, what is the impact they could really make? So what do you say to these people when they criticize that is just this kind of the new shiny horse in town, that kind of blindsides founders with those big celebrity names?
Right. So, I mean, you know, this is valid criticism. I guess the first thing is both sides should be sort of managing or really understanding expectations. That way they're able to manage that going forward. I think when it comes to, you know, there are, again, when you have someone like Will, who's on, you know, really another level, and there are plenty of folks that are on, I'm not trying to say that he's the one and only. I mean, there's Jay-Z, Serena Williams, that I mentioned before, and plenty of others. The, you know, one thing that we've actually found is that even being able to mention his name in a press release can oftentimes turbocharge distribution, especially for harder to reach demographics. And so by that, I mean, you know, for some of our portfolio companies, they'll mention him and, you know, Nas and, you know, whomever else is invested. And because of that, we'll end up seeing some African-American focused media pick those stories up, like Jet, Ebony, Essence, whatever, you know, Variety, whatever it may be. And then that gets picked up and it turns into this flywheel. And all of a sudden you have 250,000 shares on LinkedIn and all these various different platforms, Facebook, et cetera. And then really that's hitting, you know, sort of that demographic that the startup was initially, that had no idea that they actually could reach, as opposed to the sort of monolithic TechCrunch, you know, or VentureBeat group. And then the last thing I'll say is that, you know, we're minority investors, you know, we're not leading deals. We are extremely low maintenance. We took the Tiger Global approach before anyone knew what it was. I mean, in that we were totally hands off. You know, the other thing that I think people should realize is that, you know, if you think about the value add to check size ratio, we're not asking for like 20% of a company's, you know, for ownership or, you know, being on their cap table. We're taking, you know, pretty small couple hundred thousand dollar slugs. And for that, we think that we actually, you know, sort of, we punch above our weight when it comes there. So I totally understand, you know, the stigma and criticisms around celebrity VCs, but, you know, we're very upfront about what we think we can accomplish with the founder. We never overpromise and underdeliver. And we make very clear, like, you know, this is what we think we can give you for this check size. And, you know, and we hope it'll be multiples of that in terms of value delivered.
Yeah. Can you tell me a story of one deal where this panned out perfectly? Or, I mean, nothing is ever perfect, but do you have a story of a deal that, I mean, now maybe it's been 3 years. So maybe there are a couple of stories that already, yeah, you can see where this actually really worked out in reality. Is there anything like that?
Yeah. I think we have a couple examples, but the one that's most notable, and I don't want to repeat the story, but it's with a company called Step, which is banking for teens. And it started by a gentleman named CJ McDonald, who had previously sold a fintech company to First Data, with his co-founder at the time was Vinny Lingam, the founder of Civic and kind of like a crypto influencer. So CJ, you know, we met him, I think at some, whenever it was in like 2018 or something. And he was like, hey, you know, I'm going to do this fintech idea. You know, one of the most overlooked, you know, parts of this whole, you know, just of a customer is before they're 18 in the eyes of a bank, because they're not making any money. They still need parental, you know, permission to even just get their own account. Yet the second they turn 18 or 19 and they go off to college, they're getting student loans. They need a checking account. And so there's like this huge, you know, I guess like sort of like precipice in between, or cliff rather, from the time they go from being like totally worthless to a bank to incredibly valuable. And he's like, you know, what if we sort of start even earlier, when they have their newspaper delivery or babysitting jobs when they're 13 or 14, teach them financial literacy, teach them about how to take care of money. And yes, like the deposits, it's not going to be huge or anything, but you know, we just want to sort of get them as a customer. And then when they turn 18, either we end up becoming a bank ourselves and we can service them, or we can send them to all of our partner banks. And those leads are, you know, banks pay an incredible amount because the lifetime value of, you know, the bank customer is so high that like they're willing to pay a ton. So anyway, the story completely added up. He was one of the first, like Amex had tried this. Anyway, so CJ, you know, comes to us and we're in, you know, one of his first financings. And I remember, like, you know, when we first invested, it got picked up. It was like, oh, like, you know, you can always mention Will Smith press release. And he did. And, you know, a few months after that, you know, and he's just an unbelievable human, an unbelievable fintech founder. And he was like, you know what, you'll never believe this. Like, we ended up getting so much traction off of this. And you know, when I mentioned that, like 250,000 shares or something, I'm pretty sure it was for Step. And, you know, he was just totally astounded. And I think his marketing person and the folks that were sort of tracking all the metrics were like not only overjoyed, but they had, no one had seen this. And so that's where we were like, oh, wow, like we can really make that case. And so we did that, especially for a company called Landis. And this was a Sequoia backed sort of lease to own home buying platform that we did, that Jay-Z was on as well. And I can't even tell you, you know, I respond to every cold email that we get at Dreamers, because I think it's the least we could do for any aspiring founder or you know, whomever.
Awesome.
And yeah. I'd say we, you know, ever since we got that, and the whole point of Landis is to, you know, it's only for first-time home buyers, and they identify a house that they want, and then Landis will actually buy the house. And, you know, generally, if they can't get the mortgage themselves, Landis will work with them for a year, coach them, get their credit score up to a point, and then after a year, they can either get a mortgage and buy the house from Landis, and those lease payments will have, you know, will cover some of the equity, or they don't even have to. It's a no strings attached land. Like, if they don't want the house anymore, that's fine. Landis will then move it off the books, you know, on the other side. And, you know, I probably fielded like 600 emails in the coming weeks, just straight in coming to Dreamers, and I would just send them all to Landis. And so, you know, I know that that had a material impact, and even just raising awareness within the African-American and first-time homebuyer community. So yeah, those are some of our, you know, proud examples. And of course, there's an argument that, like, yes, we could always be doing more. But, you know, again, like, we're very small components, basis points of ownership on the cap table. So yeah, we're, you know, we're very happy with outcomes like that.
Yeah, I find that PR aspect is crucially underlooked in startup world. I mean, of course, the ones you mentioned, the TechCrunch, the Verge, articles and PR communications are often very successful, or like the standard go-to. You know, I think every founder that I talk to wants to be featured in TechCrunch, and then they don't really see what the impact is. But with FinTown, we've seen something similar. Like, we also try to connect really early to people that are quite connected in the scene. And of course, they're not on a Will Smith scale of any kind, but just these little connections that might not even cost a lot, that really is a big impact to just get the wheel kind of turning. And I think that's also really hard to put a stamp on how much that is worth, because that initial motion in a startup is so crucial. So especially like when that comes from like a value adding investor in that sense, that's really awesome. But that actually is a really good bridge to my next question, because I also understand you're very interested in international development in the next generation in a way. And you're also an instructor at Wall Street Oasis. Let's dive a bit into that. Like, what is your role, and what kind of topics do you instruct in?
Yeah. So this probably happened last summer, the summer of 2020. We were in this COVID summer. And I was approached by Patrick, who runs, who's the CEO and founder of Wall Street Oasis. And he was saying, hey, yeah. And, you know, for the audience, you know, Wall Street Oasis is, you know, probably one of the largest, finance forums dedicated towards, you know, sort of more younger candidates, whether that's college students, you know, recent graduates for transitioning, or getting their first career in finance, particularly in investment banking, PE, hedge funds, you know, some of the more hard finance, roles. And, you know, what he started to realize, and I think what's been, you know, obviously pretty obvious, is that, you know, not as many college grads want to go into, Wall Street anymore. They, you know, they sort of see like they can make, you know, maybe a similar amount of money going into tech, and it, you're obviously doing a lot more innovation and, you know, and all the rest. And so, and of course that, you know, what comes with that is like, you know, instead of folks coming after they do their 2 years as a banking analyst or 2 years at a, you know, as in McKinsey, Bain, BCG consultant, they don't want to go into necessarily PE and work, you know, 100 hours. Maybe they can go into venture and work, you know, 70. And again, be at the forefront of, you know, the bleeding edge of a lot of exciting technologies. And so, you know, he was saying, look, we've done a ton of, you know, financial modeling courses, valuation, DCF, like blah, blah, blah. But we've never done one on venture. And like, we know the, you know, there's a ton of late demand. So would you be interested in, you know, sort of setting up this course? And I was like, you know, and I knew it would be a huge undertaking because I'd have to, you know, put all the content. I don't have an analyst, like a personal analyst to go, you know, run all the stuff down, but I knew the endeavor would be incredibly beneficial for my own understanding. It would give me a textbook foundation of the asset class and all the modeling that went with it. So yeah, so over the course of, you know, a couple weeks, actually several months, I would say, I built out all of the content in the form of PowerPoint, a number of different Excel modeling exercises from, you know, how carried interest sort of works, all the way to, you know, every clause and provision in a term sheet, you know, what can you model difference between broad-based, narrow-based, full ratchet, and an anti-dilution provision, due diligence, how to, you know, do an ARR build, et cetera. And then finally did recorded voiceovers and their videos, you know, walking students through each of it. So yeah, you know, it finished at the end of last year. I think reception has been pretty good. I get approached by former students all the time, which is incredibly, you know, satisfying. That's it.
Yeah. How's that feedback going? So you just mentioned you get approached by former students, but how was the response in the market?
It's good. So, you know, I don't have, you know, like total visibility onto like how many people are taking it. And, but I think, I mean, from his feedback has been positive to me. And I should say that there are, a good amount of other, you know, venture capital training courses and all these things, you know, some that are offered by like big institutions. Wharton has one where, you know, you can come learn venture in 3 days for like $20,000 or something. There are plenty of others online on like Coursera, Udemy. But this one is, I think certainly is the most comprehensive, for the price. So some will just do term sheets, some will just do, you know, whatever, you know, certain aspects, just due diligence. But yeah, this one kind of walks anyone. And so like, if they start from zero, don't know anything about venture and finish, they should be able to slot into at least an analyst or associate role, having known nothing about venture before.
Yeah. I find the job that Patrick and the folks at Wall Street Oasis did with building this community is awesome. I think it's such an active and supportive community of talent-driven folks. It's really quite amazing to see, and really good role model, I think, for the finance industry. How does that influence your view on the future of the finance industry in general? I mean, you must see a lot of young talent. I mean, you just mentioned already that, you know, finance, corporate finance, the Wall Street is not the traditional path anymore. But what is it that you see in younger folks these days that might just get started? Like, what fundamentally changed for these professionals of aspiring?
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of comes down to, I guess there are two things. One is like, I think we're all in this race for human capital. So, you know, for universities, they want to find the best students. Employers want to find the best employees. Founders want to find the best employees to build their companies. VCs want to find the best founders, et cetera. And, you know, right now, you know, going back to that shift of where, you know, recent grads were eschewing Wall Street, going to big tech, I think now, or going into tech and as a result of that, you know, partially venture, I think we're also now seeing, you know, folks don't want, there's nothing you know, 10 years ago, you could realistically graduate from a great school and go to Facebook and think you're changing the world. Literally no one is probably graduating and being like, okay, I want to go join Meta because like, this is going to be, I'm going to have a positive impact on the world. And I'm not trying to throw shade at, you know, at them. I'm just saying like, this is the field in the market. And obviously, you know, you have to, you know, be an ostrich with your head in the sand to not see all the, you know, the upcoming antitrust cases, whatever. So, you know, I think it's like, you know, of course everyone looks at like Gen Z and they're like, oh, these kids are just interested in TikTok, but it's like, no, there are far more interesting undercurrents that are happening. And they're really taking place in like crypto, you know, in Discord and Twitter, behind the scenes. And so it's like, you know, the idea of this, and then of course, just, you know, being sustainability focused and climate tech. And so that's why, you know, you sort of have, all these like, you know, huge shifts in cultural trends that we're sort of witnessing and, you know, maybe even aging ourselves out of, because it's like, a lot of people, even my age, and certainly everyone older, they literally cannot comprehend how virtual real estate exists. They're like, how can somebody pay, you know, millions of real dollars for virtual real estate? You know, there's no mortgage, there's no deed or anything. I mean, you take an NFT and it's like, you know, you talk to someone older than, you know, than me, and they're like, yeah, I can just do that on YouTube or whatever. And so, you know, we're really changing around all these ideas of like ownership and scarcity. And ultimately, I think that's where, you know, the future is sort of headed. And then, you know, that also kind of builds on top of where developers are going. So at the end of the day, you know, if, as Marc Andreessen says, if software is eating the world, where are the next, you know, few years, like, you know, what are the sort of the software developments that's going to be happening? Where are the developers going? And again, they're sort of eschewing big tech now. Big tech is now what Wall Street was maybe 5 or 10 years ago. And so now they're going into those crypto or like doing things for the climate, for the planet, you know, much more impact focused. And so, yeah, so that's sort of what we're seeing. And, you know, I'll say that, and then I'll sort of, you know, add this other thing is that, you know, sort of from the capital perspective, we're in this almost like a paradigm shift, I would say. So deals have never been more, you know, there's more this year, the year of 2021, we'll have more, it's like grown. I don't want to say exponentially, but incredibly in terms of the amount of venture capital that's poured into every sector and just in aggregate. And there are going to be, I believe, more money will come from mutual funds, hedge funds, non-traditional investors, family offices, et cetera, than traditional venture funds. And this is one of the first times that's ever happened. And the reason is that, you know, we're in this, you know, low interest rate environment. Everyone's looking for yield. Inflation is going up. So really holding on to cash is like negatively, is like negative savings. And then you combine that with the fact that the world is awash in capital. And this is, of course, macroeconomically with, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars entering, you know, economies all over. You combine that with the fact that now VCs and investors are underwriting companies to huge outcomes. 5 years ago, if you had a portfolio company that became a unicorn or a $1 billion valuation, that would be an incredible outcome. You know, you're like, okay, that's probably going to 50x our investment from, you know, whatever it was, $20 million valuation when we got in. Now we have, you know, companies like Robinhood and Coinbase that are IPOing at $40 billion, $50 billion, et cetera, Uber. And so now it's like we can underwrite these outcomes to 50 times a $1 billion, you know, a unicorn. And so that means we can basically like really be, you know, sort of like fast and loose with valuations when we drop term sheets. And that's why you just see, you know, I mean, money's everywhere. Valuate, you know, multiples are totally disconnected from reality. And as a result, you know, founders are taking money off the table at the Series A and all these, you know, sort of crazy extra downstream effects. So yeah, no, I mean, I think it's like, they're going to be, venture is basically becoming commoditized. Venture capital, it's, you know, Sam Lesson from The Information at Slow Ventures writes that it's just going to be called capital at some point. And I think we're seeing that there are going to be more and more funds trying to allocate. And I think returns are looking so good that it's going to make sense for, you know, more institutions to allocate towards venture as asset class. So yeah, it's an exciting time.
Does it make you nervous sometimes?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I'm, you know, obviously not some 30-year veteran of the Valley, and I mean, really even in finance, but, you know, I graduated during the, you know, 2007-2008 global financial crisis. So, yeah, you know, I kind of think of it as having two competing thoughts in my head. And the first is that, would I be surprised, and, you know, by waking up tomorrow morning and crypto prices have dropped by 50%. And even, you know, we're entering, you know, maybe, and maybe even just macroeconomically, like with the stock markets, the capital markets, you know, we enter a bear market, all these things. Would I be surprised? Not at all. The other thing that I'll say, the other thought that I have is that, yes, we've been on this longest bull run, you know, in recent history or really history in the last 13 years. But also, if you think about all of the innovation that's happening, and especially technologically, how much, how little of a role that plays compared to the several trillion dollars of GDP and market caps globally that are still dominated by, you know, some old, you know, some stodgy and state industries. I mean, you know, fossil fuels, oil and gas is still gigantic, despite the fact that we're divesting. There may actually be a ton more room to run. And that's what a lot of these, you know, really folks at the top, Scott Cooper at Andreessen, I mean, he's saying like, we're just getting started. Like people, yes, it's the longest bull run, you know, to date, but like it can still very easily go up and to the right. And so we may be entering one of the longest periods of like, you know, global prosperity. And again, this is not, I'm not trying to make light of the fact that there's a ton of inequality and it's certainly going to make the rich even more richer than they are and all those things. But, you know, maybe macro and from a macro scale, we may actually just be just getting started. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting time for talented folks to move into finance and this kind of intersection of tech and finance. But if you would look back, like if you were your 15-year-old self now looking back with all the knowledge that you have, maybe not the same connections, but the same knowledge at least, like where would you, which area would you move into?
You know, I would, first, let me just say, I completely believe and follow in Jeff Bezos' regret minimization framework. So even though I didn't, you know, I was nearly making a salary even up until I was like 30 years old when I was in business school or like, you know, when I matriculated, loved every aspect of being, you know, in the Congo, landing there after Obama got elected, working in Haiti. You know, I very much appreciate that I was even just, that I had those opportunities to do what I did. Were I to go back, I wish I would be a little more technically like literate or fluent. So I would have loved to actually know how, I mean, even just taking like C++ classes or, you know, probably done more computer science things in college, courses. And it's funny because, you know, I took a lot of career risk, just by going into international development. Like I didn't follow this tried and true path of banking, consulting, whatever, going to a big company, rotational leadership development program. So yeah, I mean, I think in retrospect, I would have maybe tried to do a startup that was more, you know, was social impact focused. And so kind of something like Kiva, which did, you know, which did microfinance, but almost tried to go to, you know, one of those similar programs, maybe even on the finance side or whatever, but, yeah, so still accomplish like my impact, you know, like sort of that drive, but also do it with maybe a more technical, perspective. And then eventually, yeah, be a founder. I mean, that is clearly the way, like, you know, I love this saying, and even though I'm very happy in my job and, there's a saying that no one's ever going to pay you what you're worth. So that's why you start your own company. And I think that, you know, even for the highest, you know, for the partners at Goldman Sachs and big law and whatever, there's a feeling of that, I'm sure, everywhere. So, yeah, would be interesting.
Do you think that feeling is even more prevalent in minorities?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, this is the crux of like why we should be supporting, especially during last year's, you know, protests, of like Black ownership. I mean, they get shut out of so many things. I mean, the history of discrimination in this country is one of the darkest spots, I think, of our, clearly one of the darkest spots of our history. And you think about all of the downstream effects that have happened. I mean, it's still mind-boggling for me to think that my parents, who are of Indian origin, who emigrated to the U.S., I mean, 7 years after the Civil Rights Act of 1965, and it was just like, I can't even believe you wanted to come. I mean, it was just like, holy cow, this is unbelievable. And it's not that they don't acknowledge that it was such a, you know, I mean, it was just such a different world back then. But yeah, no, it's, of course, this is prevalent in minorities. And that's why that's why, you know, hopefully when people are talking about, you know, why there are no Black partners at a lot of these firms or female and like, you know, sort of really trying to repair all the gender inequity or just general inequity, you know, especially in venture, it's like, look, like the reason that we don't fund as many you know, Black, you know, there aren't as many African-American or underrepresented is the term I should be using, founders, is because we don't have underrepresented, you know, GPs who can actually see that there's a real market for some of these things. And so, again, I think, you know, there has been some material change over the past, you know, couple of years, but it's never fast enough or as impactful enough as I think we all wish it would be. So we're making strides, but, you know, the strides could always be longer, and, you know, and quicker.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Vic, thank you for the work that you do and trying to represent minorities, at least to a certain extent, in the financial world. And I think that's that impact is just going to grow over time when, seeing where your career is going to take you. And then interesting to see how your road from international relations and the foundation, the Clinton Foundation, then led you to where you are today, and helping entrepreneurs and founders in that direction. If our listeners want to reach out to you, where can they reach you?
So my email is vic@dreamers.vc. www.dreamers.vc is our website. And I say this at the end of all the podcast recordings that I've done, but our team certainly, like, we respond to 100% of emails that are received. I'm not saying it's necessarily going to get you a pitch or something, but we will review the materials, we will review the deck, and give it the fair shot that it deserves, because that's the least we could do. We really want to disrupt this, like, warm introduction, because that's, you know, been one of the large reasons why a lot of underrepresented folks haven't gotten the chance to, to sort of shoot their shot, and, like, you know, get pitched, or rather, pitch investors and all those things. So, and then we'll look to help wherever we can. I mean, again, we are a very limited team and there's only so much we can do, but, just know that your stuff will be reviewed, properly, with the same that we've reviewed an Andreessen deal or anything. We encourage everyone to send us it, if they really believe in it.
Awesome. Big thank you so much for being on.
Thanks, advice. Take care, y'all.